Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning author William Styron. He wrote The Confessions of Nat Turner, Set This House on Fire, and Lie Down in Darkness. His latest book was published 2 years ago, Sophie's Choice. And William Styron, some of the dust has settled since Sophie's Choice went into print. And in it, you wrote of a young woman who fell victim to the Nazis at Auschwitz. And the difference was that Sophie was Catholic, not Jewish. And apparently some of your Jewish critics felt that you were minimizing the Jewish suffering in the Holocaust. True or false?
False. Well, I would say, preliminary to, as an answer, that I was surprised by the relatively few criticisms that came from Jewish quarters about that very fact. I must confess that while I was writing the book, I did have some misgivings. I thought that because I did have a non-Jewish victim in this instance, that I would be receiving a lot of flack. But I was pleasantly surprised, really, that almost no major criticism came my way in that regard.
And yet you rightly pointed out 1 million people other than Jews did die at Auschwitz.
Yes, and I still stand by that, because I think the book never de-emphasizes in any way the Jewish suffering during World War II. It's whenever the subject is broached, that is the subject having to do with numbers of victims, etc., I never shrink from the fact that the Jews were the chief victims. They were. There's no doubt about it. But it has bothered me to some extent. I think it's bothered others, men of goodwill and objective observers, that in this country especially, which has had such a large influx of Holocaust victims after World War II, that it was almost never mentioned, just what you said, that there were other victims. There were, and they numbered in the millions. Often they did not receive the same kind of victimization as the Jews did, but they died, they suffered, and they were pathetic survivors, and they were not Jewish. And I felt that this legitimized my use of Sophie, who was not Jewish.
Now, in an article in the New York Times, you made mention of what you call the ecumenical nature of evil. Now, what did you mean by this?
I think just in the sense that I alluded to just now, the fact that the Nazis, certainly, I think it's been recorded now enough times, did conceive of the Jews as their chief victims. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I think it's though there's some controversy, it sprang from Hitler's mind. It went down the chain of command through Himmler and Eichmann and the others to Auschwitz and the other camps. The Jews were plainly singled out as the primary victims of the Nazi terror. The ecumenical nature that I tried to mention, or I did mention, has to do with the fact that despite this, there are many others who received the same kind of treatment as the Jews. There were the Poles, there were the Russians, the Gypsies, and quite a few others, mainly Slavs. So when I use the word ecumenical, I meant the absolute eclectic, broad spread victimization of people other than the Jews, and there were many of them, millions.
Evil turns up in your books frequently. Philosophically, how does evil happen? Does man acquire it? Is he born with it? How is it produced?
You have just asked me the question that I guess has been asked by human beings ever since they gained the capacity to think, which would begin not only with a caveman, but go on through Aristotle and Plato and Montaigne and Descartes and a thousand others, and Shakespeare and the artists. We don't know. I wish I did know. I do know this, that my apprehension of evil, such as it is based on the idea that we are, as a species, seemingly the only organisms capable of evil. Nature itself is not evil. a waterfall is not evil, but animals, lions and tigers and dogs and cats do to each other is not evil. It comes as a matter of instinct.
It's violent, though.
It can often be violent, and awfully violent, but I don't think violence per se is evil. It's ugly. It's horrible to contemplate. But only man has free choice. Only man can deterministically include harm as a component of his actions. Only you or I can say in a deliberate way, we are going to cause desperate pain and hurt to someone else or to some other thing. And that's to my mind, the essence of evil. Where it comes from, I don't know, but it's been one of the chief problems of philosophy for as long as people have been able to think.
Well, William Styron, let's go on to the Confessions of Nat Turner. You wrote that book in 1967, I believe. It won a Pulitzer Prize, was a bestseller, but it, too, made some people angry because the narrator of Nat Turner was a slave who led a violent rebellion in Virginia and ultimately went to his death on the gallows. Now, as I recall, a number of black writers published their own book to respond to Nat Turner. What was all the fuss about?
Well, I tell you, the fuss largely had to do with the fact that I had written a book, a novel, from the point of view of a black man. I, as a white man, had tried to get in a black man's skin. And the book was published, it could not have been a more fortuitous and strange time in terms of controversy. It came out in the year 1967, which was at the height of the racial crisis in America. The cities were being burned down. The civil rights movement was at its peak. The book came from left field, so to speak. It received enormous acclaim in general. It received some harsh criticism from white people, too, but in general, it was highly acclaimed as a faithful rendition of the black experience in history, and that I had faithfully rendered and artistically rendered a black hero. The blacks, I think, legitimately responded to this in a negative way. It was very difficult for them at this moment when they were trying to achieve their own identity, their own expression, have once again a white man tell them how it was. And I think that's the crux of the issue, because I think the book now has been the subject of literally dozens and dozens of articles by responsible historians, and I've never really been faulted in any major way for my historical accuracy. It struck something deep in the black soul, and there was resentment, and that's the only way I can explain it.
You are a pure WASP, and you once said that as you grew up in the South, in Virginia, you accepted absolute apartheid as a way of life in the South. You don't accept that now, of course.
Of course not, no. No, it's an incredible, shameful, really, period that's now, I think, totally in the past. It's gone. You go to the South now, and I think on many levels you have a more healthy integration even than you have in the North.
Often you are described as a Southern writer, and in fact the South does appear prominently in every one of your novels. Still, you've been a New Englander now for many years. How do you characterize yourself now in 1981?
Well, I have no apology or even much of an explanation for living in the North. When I began to live in the North, it suited my emotional needs. I still consider myself profoundly rooted to the South. I visit frequently. Many of my friends and quite a few relatives live there. I feel myself a Southerner by spirit, but I don't feel any necessity to locate myself geographically there, and therefore I tend to call myself an American writer with Southern roots, which is, I think, the best explanation for myself.
You were only 26 when your first novel, Lie Down in Darkness, was published in 1951, and That was the story of the tragic Loftus family and the suicide of the daughter, Peyton. I guess that brought you instant fame. How did it feel being 26 years old and hailed as a literary comer?
Well, it was very pleasant. I mean, it was a very happy event in my life. I think every young first novelist wants that kind of reception. And indeed, it was a heady experience to see myself even on the bestseller list. I think I got as high as number 7 or 6 or something like that, on the same list that I do recall distinctly that two other very famous first novels were on, namely From Here to Eternity and The Catcher in the Rye. And it was a giddy, wonderful, wonderful experience. But of course, you cannot live off of your first novelhood. And soon after that, I found myself just in that same strange limbo that most writers find themselves in America, a first novelist who has to continue to be a second and a third and a fourth novelist.
They have to keep coming out.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when you walk down Fifth Avenue, William Styron, do fans crowd around you begging for autographs?
No, hardly. I'm not as famous, let's say, as
Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger or a local newscaster.
Literary fame has a different quality.
It has a different quality. You find yourself sort of approached on that level when they know who you are, as for instance in universities where you identified. But I'm rather happy that I'm spared that horror.
The very short novel that you published in 1956 was called The Long March, and it dealt with a Colonel Templeton who orders his flabby Marine troops on a forced march that obviously most of them could not complete. Well, you apparently drew on your own experiences as a Marine. What was military life like for you?
Well, I joined the Marines in World War II and had a relatively easy time of it. I was most of it was spent in training. I was too young, really, to go to the Pacific, though I did end up there, but in a non-combat situation. Then to be called back in the Korean War, however, was a traumatic and very unhappy thing to happen. It was awful.
Did you have combat in the Korean War?
I did not, but again, I was saved by technicality. I'm very glad for that, but I suffered all the emotional anguish of someone who felt it was quite unfair to have to serve in two wars and then 6 years. And so I'm still writing about that. I think that the United States has had itself involved in too many wars in recent years, and it's something that bothers me. It troubles my soul, and because I think there's a possibility we might continue on this cyclical scheme of warfare every decade or so.
I'm Don Swaim, and we're talking to William Styron, author of The Confessions of Nat Turner and Sophie's Choice, and you're listening to Crosstalk. William Styron, when you were a child growing up in Tidewater, Virginia, did you ever picture yourself becoming a writer? What did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, at an early age, I don't think I really thought of myself as a writer. I remember I lived in a fortunate, from my point of view, household, in the sense that my father and mother both cared for books, and I think this is true for most writers. Most writers come from literate households. I love to read. I was an only child, and that's often another component of the writer's career. He's often a lonely and sometimes an only child. And I cared for books passionately, but it wasn't until I was well into college that I entertain the idea that I too might be a writer. So I became a writer in my late teens, and I've never deviated. After exposure to the great literature that I read in college at Duke University mainly, I said, well, this is my career. There's no other.
Well, you went to New York as a young man in your 20s, and you accepted a job as an editor with a publisher that you loathed,
right?
McGraw-Hill.
Right.
You have an hilarious account of this period in Sophie's Choice, and I wonder if you could kind of briefly repeat the incident that helped to lead to your leaving McGraw-Hill about some Scandinavians on a raft.
Well, yes, that was a... I was inclined to be very snotty and dictatorial as a manuscript reader, and I had rejected all the manuscripts that I'd read, and one came in about just that, about a nonfiction manuscript about some Norwegians sailing across the Pacific on a raft, and I felt it was dull and dismal, and I rejected it. And of course, it was a book which was called Kon-Tiki, which later became one of the big bestsellers of all time. And though that was not the direct cause for my being fired, it was it didn't help.
You also would bring in a copy of the very liberal-leaning New York Post at the time, too. Just didn't happen at McGraw-Hill.
It didn't. No, at McGraw-Hill in those days, you had to maintain an arch-conservative veneer throughout.
William Styron, you're not a man to hurry. In fact, you've only published five major novels in your lifetime, plus the short novel, The Long March, and the play The Clapshack. I don't think that was ever produced on Broadway. Yale, as I recall.
Yale, right, yeah.
I don't want to get personal over your finances, of course, but how does a full-time writer sustain himself over that long period without other work?
Well, Lie Down in Darkness made for its time quite a bit of money. That helped me. It gave me a lot of... As I said before, it was on the bestseller list. It did extremely well. That helped me for a while. And then I married a wife who happens to be in fortunate financial situation, and that of course helped too. In fact, it was invaluable. And then, however, by the time I wrote The Confessions of Nat Turner, I made a lot of money. It sold to the movies for, at that time, I think the largest amount ever paid for a novel. And so for the last 13 or 14 years I've been independent. Of course, Sophie's Choice has done extremely well.
I noticed that Sophie's Choice was purchased by Sir Lew Grade, I think, for the figure in the papers at the time, I think, was $750,000. What do you think about all of these multi-million-dollar deals involving movie rights and paperbacks and things?
Well, I can only, being the recipient in several instances of this sort of bonanza, I can hardly myself complain. I do think, however, that the situation has become exaggerated, and that too much money is often paid to books to the sacrifice of other books. I think that this has worked to the detriment of first novels. Publishers want instant successes, big blockbusters, and it increasingly reduces, I think, the chances of good first novels from getting a fair readership.
Are you going to have a role in the making of the movie Sophie's Choice?
Well, I have a very friendly relationship with the director, Alan Pakula. At the moment, I haven't heard. I think the film is in a moment in a sort of limbo. I'm sure it's going to be made eventually, but I prefer not to have anything to do with the actual making.
Sophie's Choice is really a graphic character study centered around the Holocaust, and I can see problems making a movie out of it. I mean, it must be very difficult for a motion picture to get into the minds of characters as complex as the ones you have in Sophie's Choice.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a horrendously difficult a movie. I think that most novels of complexity are almost impossible to render fairly into film. I think the most you can get is a kind of a smell. I think if the movie is honest, I have no reason to think it won't be, that there will be a decent rendition of the book, but I don't think it will remotely approximate the complexity of the book.
William Styron, looking back, I don't think that Lie Down in Darkness had a single profanity or even a major sex scene, but not so with Sophie's Choice, which is extremely explicit. What do you think of this new realism in literature that you obviously have adapted?
Well, I think it's 100% for the good. I think that the battle that was fought by some of my predecessors, my honored and great predecessors, and I'm thinking of people like James Joyce and Henry Miller and D.H. Lawrence and others, I think that this was an honorable battle. I think that the sexuality described explicitly in fiction is often essential if it suits a purely artistic demand. And I don't think there's anything in Sophie's Choice, and I'm glad to say that there's been very little criticism against it in that respect. I think that the sexuality in the book has always been rendered with artistic integrity, and this is a plus, I think, for literature.
But will it be difficult for a high school librarian to put it on a school shelf?
Well, I will say that I've had almost no sense of it being proscribed or eliminated from libraries. The one place it was banned was in South Africa. Officially, it was banned there a year or so ago, but it's to be expected that because South Africa is that way.
On May 15th, 1977, you delivered a eulogy to the late James Jones in Bridgehampton, Long Island, in which you described Jones' critics as voracious little barracudas, creepy little people, and literary magpies. Do you today feel that characterization was a little harsh?
I think that they bore down very, very hard on Jim Jones. He was a writer of, to my mind, of great value and distinction. His work was uneven, but there's a tendency in the United States especially to be predatory as critics. I don't think critics have much final effect on the success or non-success of a book. They can, however, mutilate your ego. And I think Jim Jones received an unfair amount of that.
Well, how does the editing process fit in with you? Because if James Jones had better editorial control over his later work, perhaps his reviews may have been more favorable. Do you work well with an editor?
I have a very good editor, yes, at Random House. A man who's been my editor for many years, Bob Loomis. We work hand in glove. He doesn't do anything so drastic ever as to, let's say, rewrite. He wouldn't think of that, but he keeps a watchdog eye on my prose, and he's absolutely uncanny in being able to pick the places where I nodded or dozed or where I was a little sloppy or so on. So therefore, I have highest respect for the editorial process.
You've received generally good reviews your entire career. However, you do leave yourself open to closer scrutiny than most writers because of the high literary quality of your work. Have you ever been bothered by what the critics have said about you?
Oh, well, plainly, a vicious or totally negative review doesn't sit too well on your spirit or your stomach. But I think as you gain self-command, self-possession, as you get a sense of what your talent is, and I have a pretty good sense of what it is, without being, I think, vain, I know that nothing can touch me. I mean, I'm far from perfect, and I plainly smart like everyone else if someone says I'm a stumble bum, but I know what my talent is, and I therefore criticism has very little effect on me.
John Irving quoted you as saying that awards don't really foster much good in the literary world. Now, as one who earned a very important French award for your Lie Down in Darkness and the Pulitzer for Nat Turner, what do you mean by that statement?
Well, what I really mean is I think that awards probably can create more harm than good. I think it, for instance, has to be demonstrated that the Pulitzer Prize, which I myself won, was really awarded in most cases to first-rate works. I think if you look down the list of fiction winners for the Pulitzer Prize, you'll find that most of them are mediocre. That I won it. I think Nat Turner's not a mediocre book, but it's an indication to me of the incredible unevenness of prizes. And I would say this even applies to the Nobel Prize, which I think in more cases than not has gone to people who really didn't deserve it.
A good award, though, a Pulitzer Prize, can obviously help to boost the sales of a writer.
Yes, it's a nice tagline to add to your credentials. I mean, to be
looks good on your resume.
Yeah, it looks good on the resume, and if you're announced as you did early in the program, Pulitzer Prize winner, William Styron, that doesn't hurt.
When you are not writing, what are you reading?
Oh, I read everything. I read novels, I read nonfiction, I read magazines, trash, I look at television. But reading, I'm still omnivorous. I still read a lot of the old novels.
What's an average day like for William Styron?
Well, mornings, I usually take a long walk. I like to do 5 or 6, 7 miles a day. It's essential for my health, I think. I've been told this. It makes me feel better anyway. I have lunch. I procrastinate some more in the afternoon, do some reading usually, and get to work around 4, 5, and work till 8 or 9.
Mm.
I have eccentric hours, most people don't. But my brain is not in trim until the afternoon hours.
Speaking of brains, Kurt Vonnegut said in front of this very microphone that booze destroyed his mind and he had to stop. Now, you're a man who is known to enjoy the good life, good food, some booze. Does drinking interfere at all with your writing?
No, it doesn't. In fact, I'd say that it enhances the imaginative process when it's used properly. I think when you're younger, when you can absorb a great deal of it, it can be dangerous because you really don't know the limits. You tend to get hideous hangovers. It tends to interrupt your thinking process. But if my case is any example, I simply had to slow down. I still love to drink in moderation, but I had to slow down heavy drinking because I knew it was killing me. I mean, not killing me, but just causing me such discomfort that I had to diminish the amount. So to this day, I just limit myself to a few drinks.
That may be a symptom of age as well.
Of course, without a doubt.
You once said that coming into New York City is traumatic to you because you live comfortably in Connecticut and Vineyard Haven. Why is it traumatic to come into the Big Apple?
I think I exaggerated. Traumatic is hardly the word. I have a love-hate relationship with New York. It's plainly the most exciting city in the world, and therefore I do enjoy it. But the idea of living here permanently, as I once did, is anathema to me. It's too hyper-tense. I also, I'm a country boy. I was born in the countryside, and I still love the countryside.
In about 15 seconds, is it fair to ask you for a preview of what you're working on now?
Yeah, I'm working on a book about the Marine Corps and the Korean War, something that's very close to my heart, something having to do with, again, that thing that preoccupies me, this thing about the United States always getting itself into wars it doesn't belong in.